Hello, and welcome back to Press Pause, where I have the absolute pleasure of interviewing creatives in the TTRPG space to talk about what they do and why they do it. Today, we have an awesome guest here for you all, game designer Richard Ruane. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting. It's really great to get to be here.
Yeah, I think that I met you a year or a couple years ago at one of our New York TTRPG meetups.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah,
very briefly.
So, perfect. Okay.
Yeah, I'm glad I could finally get you on to chat. First off, we got to ask the big questions. How did you happen upon TTRPGs? What was your introduction into this space?
So I started back with D&D and AD&D back in the era of TSR games when I was in high school. And then dabbled around with some other games as I could get friends to try to play them. And then sort of in the 90s went, in the last half of the 90s went real hard for World of Darkness. I feel like that was most queer youngish adults from the 90s at some point where they went real hard in the World of Darkness. The World of Darkness was one of the early TTRPGs to introduce out queer people that weren't queer-coded villains who had relationships. And I think the first out queer person hired as a line, they had lots of queer writers. I think that in 99, I think they hired their first queer line developer for Aberrant, which was a short-lived game they did. That was Craig Blackwelder. I think because I know several developers also are queer. I think they came out after Craig was hired. But I think Craig was the first person in that sort of line developer, managing editor role with them. And I got to work with Craig a good bit, worked a little bit on some Aberrant titles that sadly did not see the light of day. Got some additional writing credits and then got to work on Mummy the Resurrection, which is a game that I'm not particularly excited about, but it was a credit. And then I got to work a little bit on Mage the Ascension, and then I sort of burned out on working with a mid-size, or really actually very large company. They were the first company to really outsell TSR in the space. And World of Darkness games combined outsold AD&D for most of the 90s. And then I sort of burned out on working for other people's games and went and did some educational media stuff, did a little bit of indie comics. From indie comics, sort of let things fade into the back burner for a while, and was not doing many creative projects when I started working as a game master for Lauren Blanco at 27 Store in Brooklyn.
We love her. We love 27.
Yeah. Lauren is one of my favorite people. And Lauren and I did a couple of of D&D 5e writing things together. We had a few times because that was back when Lauren was running, had a much bigger play space than the store has now. Had about 7 tables and 7 GMs all going at the same time. And Lauren always had conceived of it as like, it's not 7 tables, 7 GMs, it's 7 GMs running a like single game collaboratively. So we had a few things where like we had really minimal adventure setups from WotC coming in that we really wanted to use, but we wanted to make sure we were hitting some overlapping beat notes and that GMs were not having to spend too much time together. So Lauren and I sort of expanded them out so they would look a little bit more like what our GMs were used to coming from WotC. And then we sort of just shifted to that. We collaboratively wrote a huge, I think 100 player, that's not huge in video game world, but I feel like in tabletop and LARP world, 100 pretty big interactive RPG scavenger hunt that went through Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and we had a blast doing that. We like I said, I think we had like 20 teams of 3 to 5 players a piece, so we had over 100 players on the scavenger hunt, and it was really fantastic just to get to work on that with people. Had so many different sort of things that were hooking them in and getting them excited. Some people could care less about the scavenger hunt. They wanted to wander around Williamsburg and talk to our NPCs. Some people just wanted to wander around Williamsburg and go shopping and have sort of an ostensible excuse for it. Some people were really competitive, and some people really just wanted to, like, you know, get their social media accounts fired up and wander around Williamsburg taking cosplay pictures. So we had a cosplay and picture and social media picture award in addition to the, like, solving the mystery award. And so that led into me doing some work for Gauntlet Codex. And then started publishing my own stuff in 2020. So
yeah, because I feel like you have a fairly eclectic range of games that you've designed under our Rook Studios.
Yeah.
I think on your website it says specifically from supernatural mysteries to historical fantasy, which is a wide breadth.
Yeah. That's been really exciting to kind of get to having my own studio and being able to just sort of decide where the projects were, has been pretty fantastic. I love historical mystery, and historical fantasy. And so getting to do some supernatural element stuff in the more modern era and then going back to doing some medieval stuff. And I think, if there's anything that sort of ties them together, I really focus on setting. I think setting is, I think, one of the uncelebrated or under-celebrated components of an RPG is really having a clear sense of, like, where are you and what are you doing? Who are you? The real first mechanics of an RPG. Where are you? Who are you? And what are you doing here?
With the kind of ability to just make a game that is interesting to you, how do you find those projects? Like, do you have any specific, like, inspirations, like authors, filmmakers, that sort of thing that kind of you drag from?
That is, I feel like it's been very different for each of the games. I feel like for Moonlight on Roseville Beach, it really started as kind of contemplating we're two different streams of pulp. Like we talk about pulp as if it's this big unified force in the world. And really it's just a whole bunch of different publishers publishing novels in a particular format or novellas in a particular format. So pulp ranges from the magazines where H.P. Lovecraft and so many of those contemporaries published it, you know, especially in the 30s when weird fiction was huge. And then going into the 50s when we first started to dabble in queer fiction. And literary houses could get away with a little bit. And the first, I feel like the first queer novel that was published that did not have a suicide ending was Pat Highsmith's The Price of Salt. But the first one to make it to pulp paperback status and get into the actual dime stores where most teenagers were shopping for their novels was Anne Bannon's I am blanking out the Bebo Brinker series. Odd Girl Out, I think, was the first one in the Bebo Brinker series. And that was the first time that the average dime store just had queer novels on the spinner racks alongside cowboy fiction and weird fiction and whatever they were reprinting. And lots of literary novels ended up sort of drifting into those dime store racks by getting sort of paperback prints in that format. But that was sort of the first time, and it was a really powerful time in queer history for so many early queer pioneers. Remember going into their dime store and flipping through the spinner rack and suddenly seeing Odd Girl Out or other books in the Bebo Brinker, I Am a Woman in Love with a Woman, reading them or stealing them, shoplifting them, and then hiding them under their, you know, on their book bag or under, you know, inside textbooks or other places because they were thin little pulp books. And so I really wanted to see about Roseville Beach to kind of bring together those. And then I made the weird decision to set that in the 70s because I felt like that was a decade that was a little easier to understand, and it steered clear of a lot of the vast social upheaval and trial in emotional trials of the 60s and then the upheavals of the 80s, primarily being HIV/AIDS. And I really wanted 79 to be a time when queer people could imagine a hopeful future. Where it was very easy for queer people to sit down and imagine a hopeful future, which was a little harder to do if you'd said it in the 60s, or a lot harder to do if you'd said it in the 80s. So that was when you're using cosmic horror, I felt like, you know, being able to imagine hope was going to be an important element of experiencing that, and not having it just become another kind of Call of Cthulhu style everything is hopeless RPG. And I love those. I love those so much. Bridget Jeffries from Chaosium is one of my dear friends, but I wanted something different out of this game. So
yeah, I feel like I just got a little snippet of queer history that I was unaware of, which is so cool and fun.
Yeah. That was something that I had only discovered in documentaries when I was very first coming out. I learned about Anne Bannon, and really only in the audiobook era did I start hunting down those novels. Yeah. So.
We've kind of talked a little bit briefly about like setting being kind of one of your main starting points, but what like draws you to a certain subject matter? Like, is it a genre? Is it a theme you like working at? Like, what do you gravitate towards when it comes to starting to design a game?
It will be a little bit all over the place. It frequently starts with some media or events that have sort of been sitting in the compost pile of my brain for a little bit. Carlos Fig McNeil talks a little bit about sort of having that mulch pile in your brain. And if you read Carlos Fig McNeil, you'll understand like that she definitely has a mulch pile. And I need it to break down a little bit more. I will never be as brilliant as Carlos Fig McNeil is, it's sort of like, you know, it's not only a specific piece of media. It usually needs to sort of kind of break down and compost a little bit. Sometimes it arises out of play experiences in other games. I wrote Sherwood after running a year long campaign of Romance of the Perilous Land, which is, Scott Malthouse's really fantastic sort of tribute to sort of an amalgam of a British folklore and British, folk stories as sort of filtered through BBC all ages specials and 90s sort of retellings and collections and fiction. And it is a lovely, lovely game. And I wanted something that focused a little bit more just on the outlaw and exile kind of components of that. And that became Sherwood, and that became my chivalric romance. And so frequently, it's sort of giving myself a bunch of homework assignments, getting really interested in something, giving myself a bunch of homework assignments, and then sort of following up on all those homework assignments. Because a lot of the reading I did for Sherwood didn't really fit into Sherwood, and what didn't fit into Sherwood sort of became my chivalric romance. So,
yeah, ideas
while we were sort of finishing off Roseville Beach. Yeah. So, yeah. And it took several years for Roseville Beach to kind of fall into place, and really seeing once I told Guy Sugars, the art director, about my ideas, and seeing the stuff that Guy was sending back, that sort of informed so much of what finally came in the book too. Is looking at Dai's work in progress on the pieces that were going on.
As a designer who has a couple games, Moonlight on Roseville Beach, My Chivalric Romance, that are centered around the queer community, what do you think is the biggest difference in games that are intrinsically queer versus kind of any TTRPG that a group of queer people can make gay at the table?
That's a really fascinating question because it comes out occasionally in play, and I don't want to pick on straight dudes specifically because a significant number of the most important people in my life are straight dudes.
They'll understand.
They understand. They get it. And they frequently love, I was having dinner with game designer Brennan Taylor last night, who is a huge Roosevelt Beach fan. It's specifically come out with straight dudes a lot at the table, and it is an intense anxiety about being seen as non-straight. Tends to come up in those games versus a sense that in the space that it's designed for is about the experiences of queer people, that, you know, it's not just gay people making things gay at the table or queering things at the table. It starts out as a queer place. And I think it also gives us a chance to connect on our shared history and experience. And I think my good friend Sharang Biswas has noted that sometimes when we get just a bunch of people sitting down and going like, well, you know, I'm not finding myself here, so I'm just going to jump in and make this all about our experience, we end up with something that's sort of intensely utopian, which can be well-deserved and fantastic. But sometimes when we do setting or when we do external adventures, sometimes what we need to push back on is the sense that everything is going to be utopian when it's all ours. That we need to remember that we need to be, you know, just putting it in the hands of queer people is not a magic spell that makes everything great. That sometimes we are not our best collaborators with other queer people. I say that as a gay man, because frequently we are sometimes the problem in the queer space. And then also because frequently we're assuming progress, that we see this with the Trump administration, we're assuming progress that actually can be pulled back or rolled back or fall back. And we need to sort of be preparing ourselves, I think, narratively for the chance that people we saw as allies may not be as committed to us as we thought they were. And may not get why we say that. And so I think when we do innately queer settings, stories, perspectives, and characters, we get to sort of tackle that a bit. Roosevelt Beach is a lovely, lovely place, but it resists utopianism pretty intensely, even when people sort of set out to try to make it as inclusive as possible. The fact that even if you're playing it as tongue in cheek, it has got some horrific elements, and those horrific elements frequently come from queer people, or it comes from the instinct to, you know, it comes from capitalism, the instinct to get what's yours. And so it's been fascinating to watch other people play and run Roosevelt Beach, and how hard Roosevelt Beach resists becoming too much of a utopian place. It's a good place. It's a place worth protecting. But it's not like a magic land where everything is fantastic and nothing can go wrong. And everything will go right. So I think that's why it's important to me to, and it's also, I think, why I frequently start with where did you come from before you get here, as central to character creation. Because that's going to inform a lot of what you, the decisions your character makes. It's going to define who they are as people. And it's not like, oh, I just magically showed up in queer happy land and everything's inclusive. And we're all going to go defeat the bad guy at the border this week.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting about making everything a utopia, because what I have found playing Moonlight on Roosevelt Beach is that almost because Roosevelt Beach is a utopia, quote unquote, all the characters that me and the other players made were bringing in the narrative foils to that. Like, yeah, we were resisting, actually, as players, this utopia by making where we came from and our emotional traumas and stuff like that so against what Roosevelt Beach was offering.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I feel like that will come in. And that's, I think one of my favorite sections in there. And I really got excited that Kameh Martin, somebody who I started creating around the same time Kameh did. We don't know each other super well, but we've interacted occasionally. Shouted it out as having the coolest romance rules. And there's no romance rules other than the GM section, reminding GMs that the point of a romance storyline is not do they get together. It's not will they or won't they. The point of the storyline is what bullshit do they have to overcome to make it happen, to like get past like we're just interested in each other. It's a mix of internal and external bullshit usually. And when you go to plot lines that involve mysteries, it frequently sort of amps up, or mysteries or the supernatural, it frequently amps up the external bullshit. And I feel like that is the point at which romance storylines become interesting, is when they are driving, when you are meeting and interacting with a competent human being, but who has some bullshit that they cannot just stay on the island. They can't just stay with you. They can't just be here indefinitely. And so they're going to need your help. And I think that's one of the things I got really frustrated with, long before I was over WotC. I got really frustrated with WotC because in several of their books, their queer storylines were just about helpless characters, you know, helpless, hapless, dopey characters who had pretty much nothing to offer the world around them, you know, and were not, and certainly, you know, that's not solely, you know, frequently all of us are helpless, hapless, and dopey, but these are characters in the story, and they're the only representatives of queerness in the story. And they're just like, I don't know what we're going to do. We have kids we're just here, and we need help. And we want to make sure that, like, you know, Roswell Beach is not about those folks. It's not about being helpless. But it is about being, you know, not being helpless does not mean you have struggles or that you're innately going to overcome them, just by sheer force of will. You're going to have to be clever, smart, and lucky, just like queer people have had to be throughout queer history. So,
my dearest listener, have I got a secret for you? Bitterton is an improvised comedy podcast inspired by the stories of Jane Austen that tells the tale of a wealthy family's secrets, scandals, and shenanigans. Lady Bitterton has unwed daughters, nosy neighbors, awful country cousins, and now a body to hide. Will the Bittertons be able to keep their secrets off the pages of Lady Bigwither's gossip sheet? Or will her pen skewer their good name forever? Oh, Bits, what a predicament. Featuring the voices of Katie Maravich, Iffy Waddyway, Carolyn Page, Alex Songsharp, Brian Flaherty, and Cassie Wilson, plus a dance card filled with guest comedians of the very finest quality. But for us to help the seeds of rumor ripen into the juicy plum of scandal, we'll need your help. Bitterton is heading to Kickstarter on June 13th. Go to bitterton.com to pre-save the campaign and help us bring this story to life. Ta-ta for now.
Well, we've mentioned Moonlight on Roswell Beach enough and talked about it enough at this point that I think for people listening who don't know what it is, we should describe what it is. Do you have kind of like an elevator pitch that you give for it?
The tagline is a queer game of disco and cosmic horror. It is 1979 on Rose Island, which is a fictionalized version of Fire Island. And as a fictionalized version of Fire Island, it has two queer towns on it, one very wealthy and one very sort of more mundane, everyday, and a little more open and out. And that little more open and out and more everyday, community is the town of Roswell Beach. And it is a stolen map of Cherry Grove, New York, which is one of the two queer towns on Fire Island. I really just sort of pulled that out of a hat, because it's the one I knew best. in addition to just knowing it best, I discovered that like it being a barrier island, being one of those long, narrow islands off the coast of the Atlantic Ocean or the Gulf Coast, also created this really cool effect where, you know, you it's easy to walk everywhere in town. It's easy to walk to nearby towns, but like those barrier islands get very long. So you may need a boat or a long hike or to hotwire a parks department Jeep to get to some of the other towns on the island. So it sort of created this kind of cool geography effect of like, oh yeah, you don't just keep walking and get somewhere. These islands are long, long, long. Not a lot of total land mass, but very, very long and narrow. And so it's possible to have remote towns that are also on the island that, we've got one for an adventure that's coming, that is going to be, just the whole town is just a big cult, a big wealthy cult. You meet somebody who sort of quietly escaped and doesn't want to, you know, talk about it too much, but is living in Roswell Beach. And they're hunting for him. Rose Island is, you know, just kind of created the geography of that. But it is 1979. It is it's the summer that Donna Summer's Bad Girls comes out as an album. And then, that is Moonlight on Roswell Beach, to summarize. And it is filled with supernatural phenomenon. But you can't just pack up and move Roswell Beach somewhere else. It is your town and your, the place where you are. So
I don't think that I need to ask what is gay about disco. I feel like that's kind of self-explanatory, but I would like to get your opinion on why you think horror is so queer coded, and then furthermore, cosmic horror specifically.
Horror specifically, I think, dabbling with the ideas of monstrosity and being on the edge and outside of the normal protective zones all sort of resonate coming at horror from different directions. I think that Hammer, this is probably not a popular opinion, but I think Hammer sort of introduced the idea of an edge of, like, even as they were lowering the budgets, they were definitely introducing an idea of sort of attraction and glam in horror. Like they had Christopher Lee as Dracula, and there had never really been anyone super hot playing Dracula before Christopher Lee. And a much younger Christopher Lee, when he started that role. And just tall and dashing and imposing. God bless Bela Lugosi, but when Bela Lugosi made eye contact with someone, it was scary and you didn't really know why people would do what Bela Lugosi wanted. But when Christopher Lee made eye contact with the camera, everyone in the audience was like, yeah. And then going into the Giallo era, and we begin to get queer characters in Italian cinema, via Giallo, and there's some really funny, sleazy, over the top Giallo as well. And just some more pedestrian queer characters. You know, the slasher era did it on accident and then kept trying to figure out how to like undo it. But never succeeding, with both, Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, never really being able to figure out how they managed to turn slasher horror so gay. But I think those elements of being able to both identify with monsters, with outsiders who figured out what was going on first, outsiders who felt traumatized by their daily lives, those elements going on at once, definitely, I think, brought together the queerness of horror. And then I think cosmic horror, you kind of have to look past the 30s era to get where it becomes explicit. But it's really the zone of horror in which Clive Barker is playing, sort of the daddy of queer horror. And to a little bit less Thomas Tryon, even though he was always in the closet. Where you just have sort of this vast, uncaring universe, and the horror is not that someone's out to get you. The horror is that the universe doesn't care, what happens. And it's so important to the work of Clive Barker, a little less so to Thomas Tryon, and I think a lot of people wouldn't call him, cosmic horror, but I feel like, Harvest Home, definitely kind of fits some of the themes of cosmic horror, where it's also, I think, one of the things that came out a little bit in Lovecraft, but a lot in later writers, is that it was not what the dark gods did to you. It was what other humans trying to control or draw on the dark gods did to you. And that definitely comes out in Harvest Home.
Yeah, I had a very recent experience with that. We made a Thirsty Sword Lesbians game that was a steampunk noir, in which at the beginning of that game, one of my players said that they had interest in part of the story being cosmic horror-like. And we got into it. And what I found difficult was all of a sudden I was like, it actually doesn't make any sense that the bad guys aren't human beings. And we haven't created a world in which like gods or these entities exist. So I'm going to have to like back away from that, because it is so much more interesting when the bad guy is the person right next to you. Rather, I think that sometimes than like this all-knowing unseen thing.
Right, right. Yeah. And when I think of Barker, I think of that, later on in the film series, Pinhead is the villain of Hellraiser. But the first two movies and the Hellbound Heart, Pinhead is not the villain. Pinhead is just an entity who is there to do Pinhead's job. And almost no one is supposed to interact with Pinhead unless they've decided to. And it is the only reason that Pinhead gets loose is because someone who knew what he was doing decided that that was not what he wanted. He was trying to crawl himself back out of Pinhead's alternate realm of pain. But who went to great lengths to acquire the knowledge for how to get there and how to summon Pinhead. And then he deciding that this was not what he wanted, doomed everyone else, in that vicinity. I feel like that's sort of that's the cosmic element to me, is that you have people making terrible decisions for entirely selfish reasons and pulling powers in that they can't actually control.
Yeah,
is what makes cosmic horror, and I feel like that is. I think it also speaks a little bit to that. At some point, heteronormativity is not, and cisnormativity are not like selected, decided social forces. They're hegemonic. They're things people tap into, and we see supposedly progressive politicians in the UK and US trying to make deals with heteronormativity and cisnormativity, and just assuming that they'll be able to control it once they're in office, and discovering that that's not how this works.
I wanted to kind of talk more about the process of how Moonlight came to be. Like, kind of what was the beginning concept to kind of like through when it was finally like published?
The beginning concept was really loose. It was really honestly Anne Bannon meets H.P. Lovecraft. And as usually when I set out to do something with H.P. Lovecraft, I end up ditching Lovecraft along the way. And I also did not quite go with Barker level of like, there's no one's going to burst out of somebody in an adventure I write for Roseville Beach or, And it originally started as sort of like a small zine with some with a map and some ideas and some alternate backgrounds from my friend Diogo Nguera's game, Dark Streets and Darker Secrets. Diogo was super supportive. If anybody's interacted with Diogo, it's hard to imagine Diogo not being super supportive of pretty much everyone. And was very, you know, very important. Like, we had not met at that point. We had talked online. And then, like that summer, Diogo came through New York and we got to hang out a little bit. And that was the first time we really got to like, you know, hang out and meet. And it's just been continued to be like a complete champion of my work and Booster. And just an incredible person. It was struggling as a zine to find much of an audience. And so it sort of got put on the back burner. And while I was working on my setting book, Barrow Keep, my OSR setting book, Barrow Keep in 2020, I knew I didn't want to, I would burn out on Barrow Keep if I only ran Barrow Keep at all the online conventions, because that was the year of lockdown and all the conventions had moved online. And I did not want to risk burning out on Barrow Keep. I decided sort of at the last minute at Gen Con 2020 to run, Moonlight on Roosevelt Beach as a setting for Dark Streets and Darker Secrets, and then did it, a few weeks later at Games on Demand Online. So a couple of different online conventions, and the response was incredible. And then a few months later, I got to do that at, another online convention, a virtual horror con. And really this was also my first, real exposure to the larger online and convention going horror RPG community. It's where I kind of interacted with people like, a lot of people who I had sort of left, who were still big World of Darkness fans, and a lot of people, my friend Kay, like my friend Bridget Jeffries. And I had not really been part of, I'd been, you know, playing in and playing games in, but never really part of a larger conversation about horror and RPGs before. So it was really exciting to kind of get that started. And then in 2021, at the very end, a group of people decided to run sort of a collective crowdfunding campaign called SideQuest in November, because November is normally a very slow time for Kickstarters. It was supposed to emulate more of a freeform community-led zine quest, like the Kickstarter-branded program. And they were super supportive, even though it became clear very early on this was not going to be zine length, that was going to turn into a full book. So I kept sort of playtesting at conventions. I playtested at Metatopia Online, playtested at Gen Con Online earlier that year, and a few other places. And then sort of pulled the notes together, got the text version of the quick start out. And then Lauren, the night the Kickstarter launch, had me and Ezekor, an Argentinian designer who also contributed to the book, on to just sort of, and Ezekiel was just in chat, because of the distance and bandwidth and things like that. But, I was in there and we got to talk to Ezekiel a good bit, back when Lauren was Twitch streaming, with their world building. And that was the night we launched, and, we funded pretty quickly. And things just kept growing. And over the next year, I finished almost everything that I needed to do by June. And then we sort of slowly integrated everything that the other writers had contributed. Brian Kund, or I maybe mispronounced, Brian, I apologize if you're listening and I mispronounce your name, I apologize. Served as our sensitivity reader and was sort of our first round of editing. Followed by Jared Sinclair. And, you know, Brian, you know, technically not an editor, but as a sensitivity reader, sort of that first round of having somebody else really look at it, Jared then went in. After Jared did like a line in development pass, we kind of got that out as a text only version. Jared then did the copy editing pass, and we got that into Dai Shugar's hands, I think at the end of October. And Dai definitely worked, like, quickly, given how much work Dai does on when Dai art directs a book. And it came out at the very end. The digital came out at the very end of December. A few weeks later, we actually ended up with physicals in hand at the beginning of 2023. So that was our first physical print run. And our first Gen Con is when we got the Candace the Magnificent was kind enough to give us her Judge's Choice Award as an Innie's judge that year. And it was, you know, just an incredible introduction to the book. It's still one of the videos I show people when they when they ask about it, because I know too much about the background and will tell you the story of queer queer pulp. And Candace will actually tell you about the game. But yeah, so much community support, so much interest from streamers. Bridget Jeffries got in touch and ran a stream in June of that year that I got to run. And then a year, like less than a year later, we were almost sold out and we had to do the hardback Kickstarter so that we could get more money for softbacks as well, or for paperbacks as well. And that's been sort of the story of where we came from. Yeah.
I like how in the creation of characters in this game, it's really freeform for the player. Like, I feel like in the dice pool system that exists within this game also feels pretty freeform, but there are, like, specific rules there. It feels like when it comes to, though, the actual just, like, character creation, I love that I just, like, sat down and was like, what is my job? You know, like, there's not like it wasn't like I had to stat out a sheet or anything like that, because that didn't really matter. It was bringing your backstory and your actual, like, character background into the actual creation that would then impact the dice pool later on.
Yeah. It's the, we keep things in sort of tables of, or a list of 3x6 or 6x3 or 6x6. But we want to make sure that people don't feel like something, that if you decide to roll rather than choose, we don't want you to feel like you've been led down a dark path and gotten the wrong choice. You know, it's every skill can talk. And I think that some of the alternate rules we've pulled in, that we'll come in and dim all the lights. We do even a better job, with an option to sort of burn tags. Or burn your skills, or backgrounds, to achieve something. I'm friends with Ryan and Ryan and Hunter at the Weekly Scroll gave Rosso Beach just an incredible review. But noted that, we need to, like, finalize some of our wording, around scares and, spooks, and we're going to be going with scares as the official wording. And so that, yeah, we'll get a digital errata sheet out to backers and then sort of fix that and dim all the light.
We're coming near the end of our conversation here today, but I wanted to see, you had mentioned that you're working on a new setting for Roseville Beach or Rose Island, you had mentioned. Is there anything else new and coming up for you, either related to Roseville Beach or not, that you'd like to and or can share with us?
Early this year, I re-released my very first game, Dark Designs and Verdigris, which is available from +1 EXP, or you can find it on Itch, on my Itch page. And then I also released Haunting of Cliff Cove. People talk about sometimes Roseville Beach can feel a little Scooby-Doo-ish, and Cliff Cove is just an attempt to lean heavily into the Scooby-Doo vibes, and also to sort of have a game that runs really quickly at the table. Like, you're just going to sit down, like, you know, the GM has a set of challenge dice they can challenge you with, and once those are gone, there's rules for the GM to reclaim them, but once those are gone, you've solved the mystery. The GM sort of like, you know, it's the big awkward reveal moment, when, you know, Scooby-Doo is like, the audience is still confused, but Scooby-Doo, you know, the characters have suddenly figured out what's going on. Coming out before the next Roseville Beach book is Silver Age, which is a Mark of the Odd lightweight D20 game about werewolves in small communities. And the first one is just called Silver Age. It'll be about the 1990s in West Texas, the early 1990s, in West Texas. A place I knew relatively well, at the time. And then, I've got three other writers who are introducing sort of their own takes on those rules with three other really small settings. Quinn Blackwell is taking it into a weird fiction version of South Carolina, along the North Carolina border.
I really like this focus on such specific places.
We really want, I feel like really my favorite werewolf fiction has like an intense focus on where it takes place. Because, you know, the werewolves are there to, defend, protect, upset, disrupt, or confuse, or like otherwise, you know, damage a very specific place and time. And it's usually not a big city. So we really wanted to have like a concrete sense of really small spaces. And I think Kyle Tam went a little against that, but we're going to see how Kyle's stuff kind of comes out. I'm really excited because Kyle is the first person to take it into a near future kind of post-apocalyptic werewolf setting. But with a very specific sort of like smaller space than you might think of that. As much as I love my urban life in Philadelphia, I know that so much of where we are right now culturally is pushing people out of cities into suburbs just by pricing and gentrification. And so I think I'm really excited that all three of those writers that we're working with are pushing out in major urban centers. And then we're going to sit down and kind of work on Dim All the Lights. Dim All the Lights started as a mystery book. And if you see a cover, it will say like a Rose Island mystery book or a Roseville Beach mystery book. But it is going to end up being sort of a standalone game. It will be compatible with the old version of Roseville Beach. But I think as I have run Roseville Beach, my approach to horror has shifted in a less Lovecraftian to a more Stephen King direction. And my approach to things like fear and the way fear plays on people is moving in a much more Stephen King mode. And we're sort of toying with that as sort of the departure point. Sort of as the departure point, it will be set in Rose Island or Roseville Beach in 1979. But it's going to be a little bit more like a complete game plus campaign plot line. In the mode of Mask of Neil Arthotep or Horror on the Orient Express, where there's sort of a larger mystery to solve and there's just lots of different locations and people doing things at the same time. Will be sort of the mode of Dim All the Lights. So it's taking a little more writing time just because I'm very sort of figuring out how to approach that. I want it to still be have a good intro focus adventure. But I also want the overall campaign to have an interesting cast of NPCs at hand. And like, you know, Dim All the Lights, or sorry, Roseville Beach keeps NPC descriptions really tight and brief, and people resonate hard with them because they're kind of archetypal for queer communities. But I want to give a little bit more detail, as those characters get looped in. I also want to make sure that those characters are never helpless and hapless, I think we default to helpless, hapless characters way too often in RPGs because it's an easy way to make the PCs important and central.
Yeah.
But it's also hard to get to build sympathy and fiction with people who don't have agency over their own lives or are just there to be rescued.
I agree with that. Yeah.
It's really hard to build sympathy and fiction with people who are just there to be rescued. So it's hard to fall for them romantically or get involved with them or really connect with them. So so that's kind of where Dim All the Lights is going, and I want to wrap up Silver Age. I've got a few writing projects, including a really cool research and writing project on queer community organizing that are outside of RPG space right now. And I want to make sure I'm not giving those short shrift. I have an exciting project that's coming out with a little known game designer named Jerry Dragons that's going to quick start. And I've got some other works with people like Sharon Guzmas and a local crew in Philadelphia called Gossamer Coast that are coming out as well. And I want to make sure I'm giving time to all those other projects before I like sit down and try to figure out everything about Dim All the Lights and get that to Kickstarter.
Well, already, I do have one last question for you. And that is, could you share a favorite moment from a table? And it could kind of be anything. It could be joyous. It could be sad. It could just be some like awesome moment, but just something that you kind of look back upon fondly.
I was running games for A Weekend with Good Friends, which is a fan convention of the podcast, The Good Friends of Jackson Elias. If you told me, 15 in my White Wolf days, if you told me there would be entire online conventions that were dedicated, that were not run for particular games, but were run by the fans of a particular gaming podcast, I would have thought you were insane. That would be like a weird little niche thing, but it has hundreds of people who go to a Weekend with Good Friends, and it's a great horror convention, RPG horror convention. And I was running Roseville Beach the year it came out for a group there. And we had a character who was playing a witch, and one of her side sort of helper NPCs was sort of a mentee, and we sort of pulled him into the action of the game. And at different points, they had referred to this NPC as a alternately a chaos twink or a disaster twink. And at one point, I looked at them and said, like, is there a difference between chaos twink and disaster twink? And they looked back at me and said, yeah, a chaos twink knows they're doing it. And I also got to run Roseville Beach for Jeff Stormer, which is just, if you interact with Jeff Stormer at all, you know that it's just an incredible experience. So,
So
that's, I think those are the ones that sort of resonate out to me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Richard, for joining me and for chatting game design and all your queer history you taught me today. And for everyone listening, we here at QueerPG, while we don't have a release date yet, we have recorded a very fun fourth season using Moonlight on Roseville Beach. Yes. And we're very excited to share it with everyone.
I am so excited to listen in and hear that. So I am really excited.
Yeah, I mean, Alex is great, and Alex ran it for us. We have some awesome guests coming in because we had a bunch of guest stars, and it was really cool. I'm excited to get into the editing booth. And
Alex is such a fan of the guest star mechanic.
So that was so clear from the first development meeting we have and his pitch for it. I was like, oh, we're going to have a larger cast than anticipated because of the guest stars.
Alex is a huge fan of the guest star mechanic. I'm always delighted to listen to him talk about running the game. So, I'm really, really excited to listen to that. So I am super, super excited that y'all did that. So. But thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, again, yeah, thanks so much. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this wonderful little chat. And until next time.